From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
America's Balancing Act in Asia. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. After creating high expectations 3 years ago, President Obama's finally getting around to the so-called pivot to Asia. Troubles with Congress, the Middle East, and Ukraine have distracted attention from the region that's key to the future of the global economy. In the meantime, Japan, South Korea, the Philippines, and other U.S. allies are worried about the power of China, a country the U.S. can't afford to antagonize. On this week's trip to four Asian countries, can the president clear up confusion about his military intentions and the prospect of a major trade agreement? Today's talking point, should we all be on the payroll of Google, Facebook, and Twitter? First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. On this week's trip to Asia, President Obama will try to make up for lost time despite continued preoccupation with the Middle East and Russia's threat to Ukraine. Can he reassure allies about trade relations and mutual defense without antagonizing China? Today's talking point, Jeremin Lanier, a pioneer of the digital world, has become its most authoritative critic. We'll ask him about the future of virtual reality, which he made famous, and how social networks are cheating their customers. First, this news update. The Department of Justice today announced guidelines for what could be a large-scale grant of clemency for nonviolent drug offenders in federal prisons. On Monday, Attorney General Eric Holder gave a hint of what was to come.
There are still too many people in federal prison who were sentenced under the old regime and who, as a result, will have to spend far more time in prison than they would if sentenced today for exactly the same crime. This is simply not right.
Sari Horowitz covers the Justice Department for The Washington Post. Hi, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
What does the Attorney General mean by the old regime?
What the Attorney General is talking about is the war on drugs that brought new laws to the United States before 2010, the Fair Sentencing Act. And really what was going on had to do with crack cocaine. For probably more than two decades, there were these incredibly strict sentences imposed on offenders who were convicted of trafficking or possession with intent to traffic crack cocaine. And the belief was that crack was more addictive than powder cocaine and linked to violent crime. But in 2002, the United States Sentencing Commission found that these sentencing guidelines, these strict sentencing guidelines, were based on misperceptions about the relative dangers of crack cocaine. And the commission also found that the disparity in sentencing had created a racial imbalance, and this was disproportionately affecting African-American men.
So it's taken a long time to do something about this. You said the Fair Sentencing Act, it wasn't passed until 2010. That's a long time after 2002.
That's correct. That was a law that was passed by Congress, and it was signed by Obama. And what that act did was it reduced the disparity in the law between the sentencing for conviction for crack and powder cocaine. But still, in the system, the federal prison system, were thousands of inmates sentenced before that law who are still serving federally mandated sentences for trafficking or possession with intent to traffic crack cocaine. And those are the people who are expected to be the ones who are asking for clemency.
The Attorney General has said they want as many qualified applicants to apply for clemency as possible. How many people potentially are we talking about?
Thousands. Thousands. There are 219,000 federal prisoners. What the Deputy Attorney General, James Cole, said today is that between 12 to 13 of those people have served 10 years of their sentence. Now, there are six criteria to get clemency.
12 to 13,000?
12 to 13% of the 219,000.
Okay, got it.
Now, serving 10 years of a sentence is only one of six criteria that they laid out to get this clemency. Here, the criteria is this. You have to have served 10 years of your sentence, at least. You have to be serving a federal sentence. You can't have a significant criminal history. You can't be tied to gangs, cartels, or organized crime. You have to have demonstrated good conduct in prison. And the people who are applying have to be inmates who would likely have received a substantially lower sentence if they were convicted of the same federal offense today.
Who makes the call? Who looks at all of the prisoners involved and makes the decision as to which should get out and which should not?
Well, that's a good question. It's going to be out of the Pardon Office, which is a part of the Justice Department. It's a division. It's been a long, troubled office in the Justice Department, has a huge backlog of cases. But the president has directed the Justice Department to improve their clemency process and get more recommendations over to him so he can give clemency. And the Deputy Attorney General today, James Cole, said that they're going to reassign the head of that office, bring in a new attorney to take over the division, and in addition, put in dozens of new lawyers, detail dozens of new lawyers to that office to screen these clemency applications, which they expect, you know, just a wave of applications from inmates who think that they may meet the criteria and be able to get clemency. All of these inmates who apply will be given an experienced pro bono attorney to help prepare his or her application for clemency.
Any opposition to this?
You know, we're reporting that right now, and we're trying to find out what the opposition on this is like. It's so interesting because Republican governors and many senior Republican lawmakers have been on board with the Attorney General, Eric Holder, on prison reform. And this is, of course, part of his larger prison reform efforts. They are all wanting to reduce overcrowded prisons.
So prisons are overcrowded all over the country, not just in the federal system. And this might be helpful in that respect to everybody.
Exactly. We're not hearing a lot of opposition right now. Many groups who have worked for a long time to try to make this happen, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, the ACLU, these groups are thrilled with this. They are working with the Justice Department to try to screen applicants.
Sari Horowitz with The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
In a moment, America's Balancing Act in Asia on To the Point.
Did you know that recycling your used car is a great way to become a KCRW member? You can donate your car, boat, motorcycle, or other vehicle in support of KCRW. It's one of the best ways to recycle. You'll not only benefit yourself with a KCRW membership and a nice tax deduction, but your car will help support all that you hear on KCRW, from music to news to your favorite cultural programs. We'll arrange everything from the pickup to the paperwork. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're only back with To the Point. President Obama announced his pivot to Asia 3 years ago, creating expectations about international trade and America's military presence. Since then, two presidential trips have been canceled because of troubles with Congress, and the concerns of allied countries have changed. Today, Mr. Obama arrived in Japan with stops planned in South Korea, Malaysia, and the Philippines. Michael Green is with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He formerly was with the National Security Council during the George W. Bush administration. Michael Green, thanks very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
One of the first things that President Obama did today in Japan was reassure that country about its dispute with China. You have an op-ed in today's New York Times about those islands. Tell us what that involves, what American support might mean, and what the background is.
Well, this is one of a series of things President Obama is going to try to accomplish on this visit to Japan, Korea, the Philippines, and Malaysia. And that is that as China's power has grown, it is demanding that other states like Japan, the Philippines, mostly at sea, but also India and the Himalayan mountains, make compromises and accede to China's demands that some of these contested islands and rocks are Chinese territory. So they've been sending ships, they've been doing military exercises, they've been cutting off exports and using pressure on these countries. In the case of Japan, it's pressure to try to get the Japanese to make concessions on a very small series of islands in the East China Sea called the Senkaku in Japanese and the Diaoyudao in Chinese. The U.S. doesn't take a position on who owns these things. We don't want to get involved in that. But when China starts using its weight to intimidate friends and allies, the U.S. Comes in, and in the case of Japan, has said since the Clinton administration that any effort to use force to take these islands from Japan would prompt a response from the U.S. because these islands are covered under our security treaty with Japan. What exactly we would do is a big question. It depends on exactly what China did. The message the president's putting down is that the U.S. would work with Japan, that we have a military commitment. He doesn't want this to be resolved militarily. He wants it to be resolved diplomatically, but he has to put down these lines to get there.
What sort of force does the United States have in that region? There was talk of moving a good deal of the United States Navy into Asia.
Well, when the president announced the pivot, which they later called the rebalanced Asia, there was a lot of fanfare about putting the majority of our military equipment in Asia. But in reality, we're cutting the defense budget so much that, the preponderance of our ships and planes will now be in the Pacific, but there won't be many more than there are now because, in fact, what we're doing is drawing down in Europe and especially in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're basically sustaining the capability we've had. We have Air Force, Navy, we have Marines in Okinawa and Japan, and we have Army and Air Force units in Korea. Many of them have been there since 1945, or in the case of Korea, since 1950. And the region wants us to stay. The Chinese are not entirely comfortable with it. The North Koreans hate it. But most of the region wants that reassuring presence of the U.S. because they want to focus on trade, and they don't want to have to worry about conflict or war. And our presence is sort of the guarantee that they have.
Michael Green again at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. So there's the military situation, at least in part, having to do with Japan in specific, specifically. Back now to Sudip Reddy, the economics editor at the Wall Street Journal. What about the challenges that the president faces with regard to trade?
Well, that is the other big piece of this. The U.S. has had such an important security interest in the region. You can see now where the economics are not only starting, but they've been developing for so long. Just look at the big country in that region, China. It is the number two economy in the world now and recently overtook Japan in recent years to become the second largest economy in the world. And, of course, China has the largest population. That, both as a strategic issue and an economic issue, is of concern to the United States and to countries all over the region, because China is shaping so many standards for production, for labor standards, for everything that's happening in terms of low-wage labor. The U.S. has an opportunity here in these trade talks to try to bring up those standards, to raise some of the requirements for workers in trade deals and workers all over the world for food safety, for pharmaceutical safety, for all sorts of products, and to bring down tariffs in these regions. Of course, there are a lot of complications with trade talks, and there are a lot of reasons to be opposed to them for some of those precise reasons. But at least what we're seeing now is the discussion going on with a dozen countries all bordering the Pacific to figure out a way to forge stronger ties that in some way become a counterbalance to China and its growing power.
How does this relate to the military situation?
The military situation is the one hanging over all of these relationships. Japan, of course, is concerned about China's power in the region. A number of other countries are concerned about China's power, military power in the region. And if you are concerned about that, what you want is an economic partner. You certainly want a military partner, but you want a country that is going to be tied in with you economically so that there are business interests, there are financial interests that are guiding the way. So if you were to look at the United States, if there are stronger ties economically between the United States and Malaysia and the United States and the Philippines and the United States and Japan, all of those economic ties are what will eventually drive the relationship and ensure that there's a continued relationship there that can survive any kind of military skirmishes or territorial disputes.
I think everybody listening knows well the products that are coming from Japan and South Korea. What about Malaysia and the Philippines? To what extent are we involved in them with economic dealings, and what sort of things are traded back and forth?
Well, if you actually look at what's been happening over the last few decades, we all think about trade in United States terms as jobs that have been lost and what's gone to some of these countries. For instance, low-wage labor, of course, has plenty of it has gone to China, but it has since spread to other countries in the region. And American manufacturers are using workers in all of these regions to develop their products. These are appliances, it's clothing, it's electronics. All of these things are being built in the region. And if you even think of something like call centers, of course, have shifted over the last two decades from the United States to places like India, and they're increasingly moving to places like the Philippines. And that shift is something that will just force U.S. companies and force the multinational corporations to pay more attention to these others in the region. But they're also, as you see growth in emerging markets, as you see growth in countries all over Asia, those are opportunities for American companies that want to export. It's no secret that the economy is relatively weak in the United States and in Europe, and the big growth markets, the big opportunities are going to be in some of these emerging economies in Asia.
Is this a trade deal that the president's hoping to negotiate comparable to NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement that was passed during the Clinton administration?
This is actually a whole new regime of trade deals. The Obama administration is working on two big ones right now, the one with these Asian countries, the Trans-Pacific Partnership for countries in North America, South America, and Asia that border the Pacific, and another one that's newer, the called the TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That's with Europe, and it's to develop stronger ties between two advanced economies. These are all multilateral trade deals, bringing a lot of countries together to perhaps address the tariffs issues and the trade standards issues all at once, so that you're moving in a big block instead of trying to do one-off deals and creating a patchwork of trade. Perhaps if these deals work, they can actually move the entire country toward the original purpose of some of these trade deals, to bring down tariffs and to bring up labor standards all over the world, perhaps in unison instead of in a competitive and sometimes destructive format.
Sudeep Reddy, once again, economics editor with the Wall Street Journal. NAFTA, of course, got a lot of opposition at the time and has been continued to be an object of criticism since it was passed. If any of these deals are in fact negotiated with other countries, they have to be approved by the Congress. Lori Wallach is director of Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Lori Wallach, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much.
I understand recently you were in Asia. I'm interested in your take on what's happening there and also what the chances for passage are in the Congress, where some Democrats have indicated they don't think this is a good idea.
Well, the TPP, in a way, is not just like NAFTA, as you pointed out, but is NAFTA on steroids. It has everything NAFTA had, so the investment rules that promote job offshoring. But then it has a lot of additional rules. Only five of its chapters actually have to do with trade.
Okay, this is the one in Europe, right?
This is the one the president now is trying to make the deal on. This is the TPP.
The TPP, okay. Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That's right. So five of the 29 chapters have to do with trade. The other 29 are things like limits on imported food safety, limits on financial regulation, extensions on medicine patents that could raise drug prices, even a ban on buy local or buy American procurement policies is in there. So what's happened is you've got those Trans-Pacific talks deadlocked internationally because you have a lot of countries who are not willing to sign up to that non-trade stuff. They'd be happy to have a free trade agreement with the U.S., but all those other rules aren't acceptable. And then in addition, between the U.S. and Japan, there's been a deadlock on actual old-fashioned trade stuff, tariffs, border taxes on goods. Now, Congress, as you said, constitutionally has exclusive authority over trade. and they have been unwilling to delegate that authority through what's called fast-track authority to the president. So President Obama goes to Asia without any trade authority and with Congress pretty annoyed on a bipartisan basis about what is in the TPP and what isn't, like, for instance, disciplines for countries cheating on currency values, lowering the value of their currency to get a trade benefit, something super majorities, Democrats and Republicans in the House and the Senate, have all said TPP has to include, and the Obama administration so far has refused to even raise. So you've got this situation where you've got TPP deadlocked internationally over these corporate items. Now, there are 600 official U.S. corporate trade advisors, which is part of how you've got the U.S. pushing a bunch of these things internationally that domestically actually contradict what Obama's doing in Congress.
Okay. Let me quickly go back to Michael Green before we need to go to a break. Michael Green, do you feel that there is, in fact, some support for what Lori Wallach is saying is so problematic?
Sure, including the House Majority Leader, Mr. Reid, who's been outspoken against TPP. I think most people who look at the Congress think the president could get authority he needs, so-called fast track, to do this trade deal with Republican votes. The problem is he doesn't want to go into a midterm election, a hard-fought midterm election, to be sure, owing the Republicans. And the Republicans may not be willing to cooperate. So right now it's pretty tough, but I think after the midterms, the prospects on the Hill are pretty good, even though there will be opposition.
Quickly, Lori Wallach, what about the Democratic base, if in fact the president would need a Republican vote?
The Democrats are on the war path against fast track and TPP, but you know something? So is a big block of Republicans. For instance, the Tea Party base groups and a lot of conservative Republicans in the House do not like TPP because it would ban Buy America procurement and it would empower UN and World Bank tribunals to demand compensation from the U.S. government for foreign corporations' attacks on domestic laws they don't like.
Okay, let's keep track of all of that and keep it in mind as we go to a break. We'll come back in a moment and continue our conversation. Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. We have another minute. So, Michael Green, again, then, there is obviously argument about this. You think once the primary election is over, or would we have to wait till the general election before a fast track might be approved?
I would guess after the midterm election, but maybe it takes until the general election. These are hard issues. It involves a lot of interests. The reason I'm optimistic, and I think most people viewing this are optimistic, is because the conservative estimates are that once TPP comes into effect, it will increase U.S. exports by over $100 billion a year to Asia. And that'll grow because in the coming decades, Asia will account for half of our overall exports. That's a lot of jobs. And I think that the president will, if he can get a deal with Japan and other countries, be able to sell it.
Okay. We need to go to a break, as I indicated. We'll come back, continue our conversation with our current guests, and add Gideon Rachman with the Financial Times as well. Later on today's Talking Point, should we all be on the payroll of Google and Facebook and Twitter? We'll talk with Jaron Lanier about capitalism in the digital world. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. President Obama has already arrived in Japan. He's going to three other countries in Asia. There are both military and economic aspects to his trip. We're talking now about the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Michael Green of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says that there's going to be $100 billion worth of trade with Asia, half of the exports of the United States, a lot of jobs involved, a lot of bipartisan support in Congress. Lori Wallach at Public Citizens Global Trade Watch is dubious about that. What about half the exports, $100 billion, and all the jobs that might be involved here in this country?
Well, what Michael mentioned was how much is projected in exports. And the studies are a little fishy, but just assuming you believe those studies, they don't talk about the imports. But it's the net, the balance between imports and exports, that actually determines how many jobs are created. And TPP includes the same job offshoring incentives NAFTA had, but it includes Vietnam, where wages are 28 cents an hour. Vietnam's become the low-wage offshoring alternative to even China. So the U.S. is expected to actually have a much larger trade deficit. Yes, exports would expand, but imports would expand more.
Michael Green, what do you say to that?
That's not what the studies I'm referring to show, the studies by the Peterson Institute and other economic research institutes. But when you do a trade deal, there is always some displacement. There are going to be many sectors of the economy that are advantaged, and there will be some that find it more difficult to compete, which is why these are a hard fight on the Hill, why there is always some offsetting compensation to help the sectors that are not going to be as competitive, and why these things do tend to pass by a pretty small majority.
Okay. So we've talked about difficulties within the argument over trade. Excuse me, not difficulties, but disagreements about trade. We also heard there are disagreements with regard to the military, with the United States having given the impression, and the president saying today in Japan, that we will support against any support our allies against any use of force by China, but at the same time we're reducing the defense budget. Gideon Rachman is the chief foreign affairs commentator and associate editor of the Financial Times. He blogs at rachman.blog.com. He's also author of Zero Sum Future: American Power in an Age of Anxiety. Gideon Rachman, good to have you on our program.
Good to be here.
How has the president done? How has the administration done in terms of handling what are very complicated issues with, once again, different people saying different things, and not just in the administration, but in Congress?
Well, I think it's an extremely difficult balance that he has to strike. So it's probable that you could never get it entirely right. But I think that the difficulty is that he's simultaneously trying to reassure the Japanese in particular, but others such as the Philippines, that the U.S. will stand by them and that therefore the alliances and military understandings they have with America are worth the paper they're written on, but equally not give them a blank check to take actions that might antagonize China and you know, at the worst, could actually drag the U.S. into a war with China, with the second largest economy in the world. And this islands dispute that the president was talking about today is a case in point. You know, in the end, why should America care, really, who occupies a couple of rocks in the middle of the East China Sea? Nobody actually lives on them. It's an issue of enormous pride and tension between China and Japan, and there's pushing on both sides. So that the risk is that if you give too much reassurance to the Japanese, they take a risk and the whole situation escalates. On the other hand, if you don't reassure them at all, the Chinese might be tempted to move. And it's that kind of very difficult balancing act that the president is trying to strike.
If these are rocks that nobody lives on, why are they objects of such pride? Why are they so important?
Gosh, well, that's a deep question. But I think I'd say that there are two reasons. I mean, there are some people who say, oh, it's all about oil and there might be oil around it. I don't really think it's that. I think basically China and Japan have a very, very difficult relationship because of the Japanese role in invading China during the Second World War. And those wounds are still kind of open. And they could kind of live with it for a while, but as Michael and others were saying, there's been a shift in the balance of power, and that two or three years ago, China became a larger economy than Japan. That gap is only going to grow. China's becoming a more nationalistic place, and actually so is Japan. And so the Chinese are beginning to say, well, you know, why should we put up with these historic wrongs, with what they regard as Japan's failure to acknowledge what it did in the Second World War? The Japanese, for their part, are getting very nervous about having this big, angry neighbor next door to them, and are saying, look, if we back down on these islands, which we control administratively, that's really the beginning of the end. You know, China is on the rampage at that point. And so they've taken on an enormous symbolic importance for these two countries. They both send sort of ships and planes. They buzz each other in the vicinity. This has been going on for two or three years now. And the risk is that at some point, it spills over into an open confrontation, which would obviously be incredibly dangerous, and in which the U.S. is implicated through the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty.
Gideon Rachman again with the Financial Times. I want to go back to Laurie Wallach with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. You were in both Japan and South Korea, as I understand it, and they are also arguing between themselves with regard to what happened with the so-called comfort women, South Korean women, during the Japanese occupation of South Korea. Are those countries more concerned, do you think, about these mutual antagonisms and what we refer to as the potential military issues? Are they more concerned about that than they are about trade?
I would say from the discussions I had with parliamentarians and with civil society representatives and even journalists there, it seems that the real foreign policy issues are much more a focus than the TPP. And in fact, to some degree, there seems to be a sense that the U.S. is pushing TPP for the interests of the big U.S. commercial interests. And it's sort of the price of accepting the TPP is the, somehow part of the price that you're supposed to pay to have the foreign policy security of the United States. And for many of the people with whom I spoke there, the TPP itself is very objectionable because it delves into all of these non-trade behind the borders issues and meddles with domestic policies on healthcare and medicine pricing, financial service regulation, etc.
Okay, I want to go back to Gideon Rachman. Given what is happening in Syria, what is happening with regard to Iran and its nuclear program, given what's happening in Ukraine, is this a good time for the president to be going to Asia?
Well, you know, his trouble is that it's never been a good time. And, you know, in the general sense, I think the Obama administration, with this famous policy of the pivot to Asia, made a kind of strategic decision that American foreign policy has to be a lot more focused on Asia, which is where more and more economic activity is taking place and where the only really plausible challenger to America as the world superpower, China, is on the rise. And therefore, the U.S. should be thinking harder about Asia. But Asia's a kind of long-term secular trend, unless these islands disputes spill over, in which case you've got a really hot crisis. But generally, it's a sort of long-term developing situation, whereas the real hot crises are in the Middle East, and they are in now Russia and the Ukraine. And although sort of intellectually the Obama administration may have decided they want to think more about Asia and less about getting sucked into conflicts in the Middle East and less about Europe, in reality, when a crisis blows up, it tends to suck the life out of an administration because that's what they're spending their time on. And so on a couple of high-profile occasions, as I think you mentioned, the president has actually had to cancel trips to Asia at short notice. Actually, last time because of a domestic crisis, the argument over the budget and the debt ceiling. But it's kind of created the impression in Asia that, well, the Americans talk a good game about being, you know, all in the Pacific century, as Obama put it, and completely committed to Asia. But actually, when it comes to it, they're always kind of looking in the other direction. They're either looking to another part of the world or they're looking, you know, just to Capitol Hill and what's going on there. And that undermines the overall message that Obama is trying to project to friends and allies in Asia, which is that, look, the U.S. is going to be as big a player in this region in the future as China, because the big question they have to face, strategic question they have to face, is, well, for countries like all the big American allies, Japan, South Korea, Australia, India, their major strategic relationship is still with the U.S. That's their guarantee of security. But their major trading relationship is now with China. And that, even if the TPP comes in, is unlikely to change. So their kind of economic and security interests are pointing in different directions. And if in addition to that, they see an America that seems a bit distracted, whose defense budget is going down, meanwhile a China that's more assertive, whose economy is still growing faster than that did in the United States, and will at some point overtake that of the United States simply because, I mean, in sheer size, because there are four times as many Chinese, five times as many, then the question arises, well, do they still put all their eggs in the American basket, or do they have to begin to adjust psychologically to the idea that at least in their region, China's going to become the dominant player?
Well, let me go back to Michael Green with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. As all of this is going on, or we're talking about it in Asia, there is, of course, this situation in Ukraine with Russia. Can the U.S. afford to be at loggerheads, as it were, with both Russia and China?
It's awkward, and it points to one of the problems with the administration announcing we're going to pivot to Asia, because if you're Europe or the Middle East, you wonder if you're being pivoted away from.
So they've changed the name now. They call it rebalancing instead
of rebalance, pivot. But the president has been using pivot in off-guarded moments. What happens in Ukraine or before that Syria has a very profound effect on what our allies and friends think in Asia. They were very worried, for example, by Syria, where we drew, the president drew a red line and then walked away from it. And for South Korea facing North Korea developing nuclear weapons, or Japan or the Philippines facing China, which is more aggressive in pursuing its territorial claims, and that Syria example was worrisome. And then in Ukraine, where frankly we don't have many good options either, the sense that the U.S. is not willing to stand up to these kind of coercive moves is unnerving for Asia. So that Ukraine-Crimea situation is the backdrop that a lot of people President Obama will be thinking about. So he has a very tough balancing act. If I could quickly on the islands, these are rocks that no one lives on, but they have much more strategic importance than that. The East China Sea, the South China Sea, these rocks, if China is able to assert the control it wants over the waters around the rocks, it will basically be laying down on the map control over the most important shipping lanes in the world and what has traditionally been Japan or the Philippines' buffer at sea against pressure and conflict from China, and an area where the U.S. and our allies have operated with freedom since 1945. So there's a lot of strategic body checking and a test of wills here. It's not just about nationalism or even fish, although those are factors as well. And that also is how allies that the president will visit, Korea, Japan, Philippines, will be looking at what he says. Gideon's right. We have a dilemma. We don't want to encourage our friends and allies to be more assertive, but we have a lot more at stake than just reassuring them. Part of the map is strategically very, very important, and it's now in play.
What are the chances? We heard Gideon Rachman mention the possibility of some kind of armed conflict. Michael Green, do you think that's what the president's talking about when he said today in Japan that we will defend Japan's interest in those islands?
Well, he said that because if the Chinese think that the U.S. is so worried about this that we're going to pressure the Japanese to back off, then the Chinese side, its Coast Guard, its Navy, its Air Force, will be tempted to be even more forward-leaning and more aggressive. So the president has to say we'll stand with Japan because he has to deter or dissuade our Chinese friends from thinking they have more room. Then the question is, how do you get some kind of reasonable moderation of this problem? A diplomatic solution will be hard, but in the near term, I think the play is confidence building and transparency. The U.S. Chief of Naval Operations just signed a symbolic agreement with the Chinese and other navies to make it easier for ship captains to be able to communicate with each other. That's the kind of thing that has to be done to avoid an accidental collision as more and more ships and planes start maneuvering around these islands. That'll buy some time because the diplomatic outcome will be a lot harder to find.
Gideon Rachman, are the countries of Asia, do you think, and particularly China, looking at that red line that didn't turn out to be a red line in Syria and at the situation in Ukraine where it appears that President Putin can pretty much do what he wants? And if so, might that embolden them in terms of their territorial ambitions, or is their economic relationship with the United States so important that they don't want to endanger it?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? And I think the Russia issue is very interesting, both because of it sends a signal, as Syria does, about, well, you know, how much is America able or willing still to play the role of global policeman, you know, at a period when it's clearly very war-weary, when, you know, it's trying to bring to a close wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. We all see these opinion polls showing American isolationism, in inverted commas, at high levels comparatively. And so everybody's saying, well, you know, there are these little tests of America's willingness to play this role of global policeman, and perhaps the next test might come in Asia. And I think another parallel with Russia is this trade-off between globalization and the global economic integration and how much that acts as a check on trading partners who have different political interests. But that sounds a bit abstract. What I mean is that people said until recently, well, you know, Russia won't really risk an all-out geopolitical confrontation with the U.S. because, after all, the economies are so interlinked and they wouldn't want to take an economic hit, and would they want to risk sanctions and trade and so on? Well, the answer that's coming in is, well, yeah, it does look like President Putin is either willing to take a blow to the economy or believes that we're bluffing on sanctions, or a bit of both. And that has a read across to China, because the economic relationship with China is even more intense. And, you know, our ultimate guarantee for, well, why there wouldn't be war with China is partly nuclear weapons, but it's also the idea that in a kind of globalized economy, it's anachronistic that the mutual economic interests are so intense that in the end they would trump these geopolitical conflicts. Now, that's proving not necessarily to be the case with Russia, and it's going to be a very, very big question in the years to come with China.
Okay. And thank you all very much for giving us a really good sense of what the challenges are now and how important this trip is, not just for the short term, but the long term as well. Gideon Rachman again with the Financial Times. Laurie Wallach, thanks to you, Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Michael Green at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and our earlier guest, Sudeep Reddy, with the Wall Street Journal. Great to have you all. Jaron Lanier was a pioneer of virtual reality. He sold a startup to Google, and he helped Walmart and Fannie Mae and banks and hedge funds all learn to use computerized information. He's now working on several projects for Microsoft, and all that has made him a uniquely authoritative critic of the digital economy that he helped to create. Last year, in Who Owns the Future, he argued that Google and Facebook and Twitter should be paying all their users, you and me, for making those companies rich. We'll talk with him in a moment on To the Point.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
We're on only back with today's talking point. Since Who Owns the Future warned about the dangers of the digital economy, we've learned more about the downside of big data, especially from Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA. In addition to that, Twitter's gone public, Google has drones, now Facebook says the next big thing is virtual reality. Who Owns the Future is now out in paperback, and the author, Jaron Lanier, has joined me in our studios in Santa Monica. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk first about the thesis of your book, or one of the theses in your book. And how is it that you argue that these social networking companies owe us all something?
Well, the example I like to start with is the folks who translate documents from one language to another. So they're seeing a loss of employment and a loss of future prospects. It's very similar to what's happened to musicians and photographers and journalists, which is not to say that it's totally gone away, but it's gotten a lot smaller and it's become much more of a star system. People can these days just translate a memo or something using the automatic services. But here's the tricky thing. Those algorithms that do automatic translation are not just magic Wizard of Oz, you know, supernatural creatures that somehow understand human language. Instead, what they do is they comb all the real translations done by real people by the millions every single day to find little instances where somebody's translated a turn of phrase to reuse and mash up into the new translation. And they have to keep on doing it because you need all the pop references, all the cultural context. So essentially, we still need those translators. It's just that now we're not paying them. See, so it's a bit of a trick here. What's happening is we're centralizing all the wealth with whoever has the biggest computer, even though all the people who did work before are still just as needed as they ever were.
So in other words, the information that the computers use was originally produced by human beings who aren't getting paid for it.
There's no such thing as information that isn't produced by human beings. I mean, this is something you have to understand. Machines are not autonomous. That's our fantasy. We like like to identify with this idea of autonomous machines because we imagine that they'll make us immortal someday or something. But aside from our fantasy life, everything comes from people. It's only meaningful to people.
All right. What about the people who use social networks and your idea that we ought to have some sort of nano payment system? How would that work?
Well, you know, what's funny about this is that the very first idea for digital networking at all, ever, dates back to 1960, Ted Nelson's work at Harvard. And it started with the idea that you'd pay people for contributions to a digital network. And the reason to do that, it might sound crazy right now, but the reason to do that is otherwise nobody will be employed when the machines get really good. I mean, this is an old, old problem that goes back centuries. People have wondered, well, when there's a lot of automation, there's a lot of high-quality machines, and people aren't needed, does everybody starve? Do we rely on the generosity of committees who dole out benefits? How does it work? But the thing is, it turns out that these fancy machines do need us. The only question is whether we acknowledge the human role or not. And so if we acknowledge it by paying people, we can still give people individual autonomy and still have power spread out widely, which is what you need for a democracy.
But wouldn't the mechanism for paying them, first figuring out what the value of their contribution is and then paying them for it, be a nightmarishly difficult thing to do?
Well, you know, you haven't seen the Sausage Factory, and I have. I've seen how we do things currently.
I have covered the Congress.
I have testified in Congress and been there quite a lot, and I've also participated in the build-out of the Internet, and I can tell you the Internet is worse, and that might shock you.
That does shock me. I can't believe it.
So far as I can tell, if we just acknowledge the truth, which is that all value ultimately comes from people, and just track that, it'll actually make things easier. I mean, just to give you one example, right now, most of the traffic on the Internet is fake traffic that's just generated to manipulate the results of things like the Google search engine just to sort of earn some small advantage. So the whole Internet is multiplied many times over with fake fraudulent traffic just as this huge game of manipulation.
Elaborate on that. What's fake about it?
Oh, like the people will pay to have somebody program a scheme which creates fake Twitter followers so they seem to be more popular than they are, or fake people visiting their website so it'll get referenced more often so it'll become more visible. And these crazy—
And that's now the dominant source of information?
Yeah, that's actually most of it, which, by the way, is a crime against the planet because of the carbon footprint of the Internet,
sure,
which is non-trivial. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, it's just an absurd game. I mean, if we just kept track of who was real, who was actually doing something and paid them, just that honesty would simplify everything ultimately.
If you could figure out how to do it.
It's not hard. It might sound hard, but it's easier than what we're doing because it makes sense.
Okay. You've had a lot to do with virtual reality, and now we have Facebook buying Oculus, a virtual reality startup, and saying this is the next big thing. You've been messing around with this for a long time. What about it?
It's kind of charming to me. I mean, I always resist the urge to sort of be the old fogey about this, because if you look at Oculus's saga, it's kind of similar to my little startup from the 80s, which became incredibly visible and actually caused a lot of money to move around and whatnot. And that was called VPL, which is a less memorable name. But
describe for our listeners what it was.
It was the first virtual reality company. And yeah. We made the first, we sold the first goggles, and in those days we used gloves to measure your hands. We made the first avatars. The serious work we did was working on the first surgical simulators, real-time surgical simulators, and the first real-time vehicle prototyping equipment. Like we were more involved in industrial stuff because it was way premature to do consumer products, but it caught the public imagination, and it, in a similar way. I mean, there was this wave of almost mania about it, and it was great. It was a wonderful experience, and it's nice to see people experiencing that again. I mean, I think it's kind of charming.
Does it have the kind of applications that you hoped for that were not necessarily consumer applications, but I could call more serious than?
Well, look, a virtual reality can either be the most beautiful, creative, and profound technological medium ever, or it can be the creepiest thing ever. And both are absolutely real possibilities. Yeah. On the beautiful side, it's hard to even know where to begin. But I'll tell you the most wonderful thing about it is when you're in a simulated world utterly, which very few people have experienced, and it's done well, which even fewer people have experienced so far, what you notice is that you don't have the reference point to your own physical body because you're experiencing yourself being a squid or something. You don't have a reference point to the normal physical world because you're not perceiving that. So what's there? It's just your consciousness hanging there. So what it does is it highlights the existence of you yourself. It's a kind of a mystical experience. It's actually something, I think, astonishing that I think a lot of people will find tremendous meaning in. On the other hand, my buddy Jeremy Bielenson at Stanford and I do research with turning people into different creatures. And Jeremy can reliably make you fail in a negotiation by subtly changing your height and your race, I'm sorry to say, and many other factors about you in the course of the conversation. So you can use it to manipulate people. And given the way the internet's been going, that scares me tremendously. I can sort of imagine some future Facebook advertiser paying to make people feel miserable and fail until they buy their product. You know, it could become a sort of a psychic blackmail or something. Psychic, not in the supernatural sense.
Time spent with you goes very rapidly. We only have a minute left. I understand you're not on Twitter or Facebook.
Yeah, that's correct. I just became aware from your station that there of a new batch of people masquerading as me on Twitter, but I feel plenty exposed. I don't need to promote myself more, so I don't use that stuff, but I know a lot of people pretend to be me for some reason. I don't know what the appeal is.
Well, if you were getting paid for the information, would you change your mind and do it after all?
It would be a choice. I mean, the great thing, there are a lot of problems with the market economy, and markets fail a lot, and I want to acknowledge all those. But I also want to say it does give you a sense of personal autonomy and ability to set your own trade-offs. So I don't think it's wise to make the pursuit of money your only criteria, you know, and I wouldn't do it in the virtual world or in the physical world.
Jaron Lanier, you're going to be here and visible in the Los Angeles area tonight.
I'm going to be at Page's Bookstore in Manhattan Beach this evening at 7, and I'm going to talk about the book and also play some music, and Harper Simon's going to join me to play as well, so it should be a pretty cool event.
Okay, and you are a musician yourself with a lot of exotic instruments.
I'll leave that to other people's opinions, but yes, I do. I do also play music.
Okay, once again, you can see and hear Jeremy Lanier tonight in Manhattan Beach. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.